which I think I'm going to have to move right along here, or we're not going to have enough time, so you may bear with me if I fall on my face when I run the tape machine, but be that as it may. Sort of electrical recording has always fascinated me because it gives us a chance to finally hear in quite respectable sound the past, and also to the Canadian aspect of the whole process, because although I have often been aware that these were quite different in the Canadian market, it is only recently that I have collected enough material to sketch it in a reasonably complete fashion. If we're going to talk about the introduction of electrical recording, in Canada we have to begin before 1925 with the Berliner Gramophone Company, which was the Canadian Victor affiliate. It underwent some violent changes in the early 20s. The most surprising, of course, was the resignation of the man who had guided the company from its earliest days, its vice president and general manager, Herbert S. Berliner. Now, Herbert S. Berliner was one of the triumvirate which owned and operated the company. Of course, his brother Edgar served in various roles, usually secretary treasurer. And of course, Emile Berliner, who is the inventor of lateral cut recording. The Montreal Press on April the 19th, 1921, read, H.S. Berliner resigns as head of the gramophone concern. And of course, this was the public announcement of the culmination of a power struggle within the organization and involving the Victor Talking Machine Company over the recording policies of the Canadian affiliate. The dispute centered around from which studios the Canadian popular issues would originate, those in Montreal, Quebec, or those in Camden, New Jersey. Herbert Berliner had originated a series of his own in Montreal, and we understand Victor was dismayed at the process of declining Canadian royalties, because if you look at the record lists of the early 20s, there was hardly anything coming from the Victor Talking Machine Company. Most of it was coming from Montreal. Victor, and of course, they were able to apply pressure via Emile Berliner, Herbert's father, of course. There was, too, the matter that Herbert Berliner, by virtue of the fact that he owned the Compo Company of Lachine, Quebec, which was pressing the OK line for the Finola Company in Kitchener, was, in effect, competing with his home company, Berliner Gramophone. And at any rate, the battle was bitter and acrimonious, and there are reports that I have heard quite recently of the brothers literally coming to blows in the head office of the Berliner Gramophone Corporation. There was supposedly the story that Herbert Berliner grabbed an ashtray and thumped his brother over the head, and understandably he was upset, and when the smoke cleared, Herbert had gone, his brother Edgar was installed as managing director, and the Victor Talking Machine Company was dictating a great deal of the recording policies, but not all, as I will soon demonstrate. But the two brothers Berliner never spoke to one another again, and although they never spoke, each one knew what the other was doing, because as we all know, in any family feud, there's word gets back from one branch to the other, and I think it did in this one too. Herbert Berliner and several of the heads of departments from the Berliner Gramophone Company were now concentrating their efforts on the Compo Company, Limited of Lachine, Quebec, a suburb of Montreal, and proceeded to give the Berliner Company, soon to be renamed the Victor Talking Machine Company of Canada Limited, some very healthy competition which I feel sure prompted a change in policies of Canadian Victor vis-a-vis those of the parent company. Compo, as H.S. Berliner's own record firm, was a progressive organization, and Berliner never missed a chance to score one on Victor, and with brothers at the helms of the two corporations, who rarely saw eye to eye in private or in professional life, competition was sometimes fierce and often, in retrospect, as amusing. It was very amusing. And with this as a background, let's examine the recording industry in the face of radio. The early 1920s were a period of intense electronic experimentation and innovation. The rapid advance in vacuum tube technology in the wake of World War I wireless experiments and Bell telephone work and line amplifiers meant that finally high-quality amplifiers were available. As Michael Beale has pointed out, all the raw materials were available for electrical recording if only experimenters had been able to crack the code, as it were. This was not lost on the recording companies. English Columbia's technical department under W.S. Purser was particularly responsive in the wake of the Guest and Merriman process. Guest and Merriman, of course, are the two, one was British, one was Canadian, who had developed a very early form of electrical recording. It was used to an on-location recording to record the burial of the unknown soldier at Westminster Abbey in 1920, and Columbia pressed this, and they this, I think, piqued the interest of W.S. Purser. But even Victor, as Michael Beale has pointed out, issued a work order allowing James Owen and Albertus Hewitt to experiment in Camden. But the results were in all cases unsatisfactory to the executives. And when one hears some of the test records made by Guest and Merriman, it's easy to hear why. The lack of mechanical damping and the recording cutters resulted in spurious mechanical resonances causing severe distortion. So it was not until the work of J.P. Maxfield and H.C. Harrison from the Bell Labs that the major companies adopted, with a gun to their heads as it were, electrical recording and the reality of radio, even though the labs at Victor and Brunswick had allowed work to be done. It was by an outsider, and the public demeanor of the companies was as a phonograph concern. In the case of Edison, the private one was the same, but not having access to the voice of the Victor, house organ, I cannot say whether Camden was hinting that they were aware of new currents or not. Things were very different in the Canadian company. As early as 1921, the March 1st edition of the Toronto Daily Star carried the following His Master's Voice ad. His Master's Voice records by wireless telephone. By arrangement with the Marconi Wireless Telegraph Company of Canada, a His Master's Voice Victrola concert featuring the latest and most popular selections will be given tonight and every Tuesday from 6 to 9 for the benefit of wireless students. Those who own amplifiers, in quotation marks, can arrange an entertainment both novel and interesting. There are many radio receiving stations in and around Toronto that can receive wireless telephone communications. Look for one in your neighborhood. Find out who your neighbors are that may have one and impose on them, I guess. Stations within a radius of 200 miles of Toronto should be able to enjoy these wireless telephone concerts, as every record will be heard as clearly and as distinctly as though playing on your own Victrola in your own home. A similar project had been instituted in Montreal the year before, that's 1920, and received a good deal of publicity. Not only that, but the vice president of Berliner Grammophon had guests in his home to listen to the first broadcast, presumably on his own wireless telephone apparatus. I think it is safe to say that this indicates a certain receptiveness to new technical developments, specifically those which would result in electrical recording. Even after the great purge of 21 at Berliner, I think a climate conducive to innovation persisted, so that by 1924, when it became obvious that change had to come, the Canadian trade was ready. As Christmas approached, in 1924, the answer to Victor's traditional December question, will there be a Victrola in your home this year, was in 1924, no, make mine a Radiola Superheterodyne. The Toronto papers were full of phonograph ads reading reduced, and $5 puts a real Victrola in your home. The ultimate of this was the Edison dealer, Thomas Claxton at 250 Young, which read, free Edison records. With each new Edison record bought before Christmas, we will give a free new Edison record of equal value from a selected list, which implies that things were not going well for T.A. Edison. But it was the R.S. Williams Company, in the face of competing radio and phonograph combinations such as the Brunswick Radiola and the Fonola Grimes Reflex, manufactured in Kitchener, which is about 60 miles west of here, who broke the ice. They offered a Victrola 211, the radio adaptable, with a Radiola 3. This was noteworthy for several reasons. It was a Victor product sold with radio, and moreover, R.S. Williams was an extremely prestigious firm, and the Ontario jobbers for the entire Edison line. Small wonder the ads read a most important development in radio and phonograph history. Now, I may see if my audiovisual will embarrass me right now. We'll see what happens if we can get it to work. That's yours. I went up there and changed those reels. right. There we go. Now, this is, of course, these are, of course, two supplements. One reading Berliner Grammophon before the name was changed to Victor Talking Machine Company of Canada, which you can see by 1925. Now, this is, here's the ad from the R.S. Williams company. It's a big ad. As I say, the text of the ad implies that Canadian Victor had given their blessing. It reads, this latest achievement, the Victrola Radiola, offers the result of the combined skill and resources of two great organizations, the Victor Company and the Canadian Westinghouse Company. But Victor itself had a line of its own originating in Montreal, which was unveiled in the late spring of 1925. This marriage of convenience was announced, thus the linking of two famous names, Victor and Northern Electric Radio. Northern Electric Company Limited take pleasure in announcing the appointment of the Victor Talking Machine Company as the sole distributors for the trade of their entire line. And the miracle had occurred. A radio with a His Master's Voice trademark on it, the Victor Northern, not to mention a Victrola with radio and a radio adaptables. And of course, these are some of the sets. And you can see here we have, these all came with the dog looking into the phonograph
And as you can see, the 5-tube radio set for console Victrola is there. And I think the most bizarre is the Victrola 80 with a 3-tube regenerative in the record compartment. And of course, these machines must be some of the rarest in the history of recorded sound in view of their brief fling before the public. They were obsolete, of course, in 1926, and the small size of the Canadian market. But they were acoustic machines with radio issued with the Victor Company's blessing. I wonder, too, in view of the R.S. Williams combination, if these machines were not intended to be introduced for the Christmas trade of 1924. And here are some of we see Victor Northern phonograph unit there at the side, which would convert your phonograph into a Victor Northern loudspeaker. Now, in counterpoint to these developments came the matter of electrical recording itself. It too was waiting in the wings in the spring of 25. The Canadian Victor Company was planning a campaign of introduction radically different from Britain and the United States, where everybody kept a mum. But first, on June the 20th, all 75-cent acoustic records were reduced to 55 cents, an unusual opportunity, read the ads, for 16 days only, actually until 1926, but this sort of factual nitpicking never bothers copywriters. The series of announcements continued for the next 2 weeks. Have you got yours? All the catalog reduced 20 cents except red seals. And then on July the 9th, this ad appeared, which we'll have to say is not reticent about revealing what's going on. Although it's interesting how coyly they avoid the term electrical recording. I have referred to this figure as an amalgamation of the Archangel Gabriel and Saint Cecilia. But actually, what it looks like is the angel on the Dufferin Gates at the Canadian National Exhibition. So anyway, this is the spirit of electrical recording. And behold the revolution, of course. The campaign was a roaring success, to judge from the amount of material one finds. It's very easy to judge. This is by December 25. Everything is Dance Records VE process. And the Victor gift at a price for everyone, we see 55 cents. They were still selling the acoustic records at 55. 75 cents, his master's voice, Victor Black Label Records, made by the famous VE process. So by December of 25, it was the famous VE process, at a time when everybody else was supposed to not know anything about it. This is just the back page, VE process that everyone will want to own. These are these odd series of recordings which were only issued in the Canadian market, which are the Victor acoustic number with a prefix 1 on them. It's kind of like the greatest hits of the acoustic catalog redone electrically for the Canadian market with the same catalog number. This is the Canadian Victor acoustic label. Shall I have it bobbed or shingled from the Dumbbells Review? Introducing Yum Yum Yum. And this is the his master's voice Victor VE process label. And you can see that this is 19685, which means it's very early. And they changed the color, of course. They went to the black label recording. There's some also too, at this time Canadian Victor issued record 19571 to the dealers. Now, there's some question about this, but anyway, this rather clever product had two versions of the same selection, one on each side of the record, You and I by Jack Schilkritz Orchestra, the only difference being that one side was acoustic with the acoustic label, the other side was electric with the new black label, VE process label. Now, I had presumed this was, rumor had it that this was done at this time, but just this morning, the wonderful Brian Boyd pointed out that the electric side says use tungstone stylus, which was not put on the Canadian records until probably 1926. So this record stole some of my thunder because I don't think it's as early as I thought. Because you can see on this, it says for best results use his master's voice needles, which is what the Canadian recordings said. Okay, but things didn't go exactly as planned with the Victor introduction. It was as successful as they were. Compo, of course, struck again. Originally, the 55-cent sale was to begin June the 23rd, Why the change? Ed Mook, in his History of the Canadian Recording Industry Rollback the Years, tells why. Compo, in their usual fashion, goaded Victor into a change of plans. Having got wind of their plans, Herbert Berliner announced on June the 18th that to boost summer business, the entire Compo Apex line would be reduced to 55 cents starting June the 22nd, thereby cutting Victor's grass. What Mook doesn't relate is the topper of it all. 2 days before the Victor's earth-shattering announcement, the end of the old era and the forging of the new, Compo struck again. We can't keep back the good news any longer, said Compo. Now, I have some of these Compo ads. I've run some of these off, and I didn't, of course, run it off.
I'm about too far from the mic.
I'll be back. You could. This is past the mouth. This is Compo's ad. We can't keep the good news any longer, caroled Compo. The large sales enjoyed by Apex Records and the flattering remarks paid by their wonderful volume and purity of tone by our many customers are due to astonishing improvements recently made in our laboratories. This was followed by a selected list of records, and I understand that Victor was not pleased. My first thought upon reading the Compo's July 7th advertisement was that Herbert Berliner had quite possibly produced a masterpiece of hyperbole. That is to say, there may have been work going on in their labs, and that a few sides were indeed electric, because it is fairly well known that Compo issued two of the Marsh recordings of Jesse Crawford from the Autograph catalog, which is what these are. This is from the Autograph, Chicago, the Marsh Laboratories. And two, it is the common cant of Canadian collectors that Compo was recording electrically in 1924, but for once, rumor and the advertisement are entirely correct. The National Library in Ottawa has in its collection three small 5x7 notebooks entitled Electrotone Tests, which outline the electrical recording work done by T.H. Letts, an engineer with the Montreal Light, Heat, and Power Company, and a friend of Herbert Berliner's. He didn't work for Compo, he was just a friend of Berliner. And Herbert Berliner between mid-June 1924 and the summer of 1925, when it seems that Compo stopped regarding the process as experimental. The recording was done in the Compo studios at 117 Metcalfe Street in Montreal. And by the time the first book had begun, the work had progressed to the point where they were assigning a series of matrix numbers to the process. The series ran to E382, by which time the regular matrix series was used, and an E suffix was added if the recording were electric. Now, the notebooks are intensely cryptic. Jim Kidd has mentioned the extreme secrecy surrounding this work, but it is not surprising that Berliner was experimenting. He was a trained engineer whose interest in broadcasting dated from 1920. Berliner was a personal friend of Frank Capps at Pathé, who were processing the Bell Labs experimental work. Compo and Pathé had a close commercial relationship. Numerous Pathé sides appear from the Compo list, and ultimately Compo recorded sides for Pathé before they had an electrical process of their own. One of the reasons they were so secretive is, I've heard, is because of the vacuum tubes they were using were not licensed for experimental work. Now, I have one.
If I could find it.
And here's the type of vacuum tube they were using in their amplifier. I'll pass this around. And if you read the notes on the side, that you probably have to forfeit your firstborn if you use this for anything except receiving radio signals on a home receiver. The sale of the device carries a license for the patent claims A, but only for amateur experimental and entertainment radio uses where no business features are involved. And they meant it. And RCA was not reticent about suing anybody in the 1920s. So you can take a look at this. But what was the Berliner method? From the notebooks, I have divinated that Compo was using two amplifiers, one from Western Electric, which is from the States, and the other from Northern Electric, which is, of course, the Canadian affiliate, using the tube number 215A, dubbed the Peanut, because of its size and shape. Now, this is from Mook's book, but this is, I think, exactly what it says. This is the 1924 lab. Now, there's a batch from the Peanut tube, Western Electric 215A. And we'll go back here. Now, Berliner, of course, was using the 215A dubbed the Peanut because of its size and shape, hence the terms Peanut and Reg sprinkled throughout the notebooks. Now, the Peanut tube amplifier was the Northern Electric, and the Reg, regular, was the Western Electric using 01As. sprinkled through the notebook depending on which amp was used. The amplifiers, or at least one, was of a resistance-coupled type, hence the reference to leaks and grid leak resistors used in this type of hookup. And here on his on the stool there, you're looking at our mica capacitors. I brought one of those too that I'm going to pass around with a pile of the grid leak resistors, which he was using interchangeably to more or less balance his cutter. But I'll get to that. Brian Letts had managed to whip up a cutter which I feel was a sort of hybrid acoustic and electric device. The standard acoustic cutter was connected to a diaphragm as an acoustic process, not to a diaphragm as in a standard acoustic process, but to the drive unit from a Baldwin loudspeaker. Now, we'll move on here. Now, this is one of the sketches which didn't turn out very well. I have a Xerox of the Baldwin unit, which I'm going to pass out. Now, there's the Baldwin unit. Grab one of those because that's a Xerox from the thing, and you can see that there is a modification of there. You can see the reason I think of this sketch is there was a modification of the Baldwin loudspeaker unit. Now there's a Baldwin loudspeaker unit from the 20s, and here it is. This is what you're looking at. You can look at this one too. You can see there on the end there's the two screws. There's nothing, whereas here he's trying to indicate some little doohickey which they had stuck to the end of the drive mechanism to run the cutter. Now here's the unit. Don't pocket it, or my cousin will kill me. Anyway, the second hookup used a Northern Electric loudspeaker unit, and tests were made from live recordings and from radio broadcasts, a Marconi receiver being used. There are references to Baldwin micas in 60-millimeter glasses, so it would seem that some of the experiments used the speaker diaphragm as one would have used an acoustic cutter. Also, too, I think some of them just use a loudspeaker into the horn. The distortion which plagued other experimenters was avoided by Compo in two ways. They bridged the output of their amps with a capacitor and reference to the various values fill the notebooks. They did this, of course, in order to smooth the resonant peak of the microphone, which I think was a Northern Electric double contact carbon mic. Secondly, there were numerous notes concerning rubber bands and felt and raw cotton damping of the cutter. The result, of course, was a workable electrical system for live and off-the-air recorded. As early as December the 4th, 1924, the first electricals appear in the standard ledgers, which is matrix E14, still the experimental series. L'amour se souvient by Hercule Levoix, who was a baritone, was issued on star 15192. Certainly by January, Mazurka Sentimental by Pace's Mandolin Orchestra was soon going to be in the catalog, which means that by December, January 24, 25, Compo was issuing electrical recordings. The term electrotone, which I think was quite clever, evidently fell by the wayside, and the term ultimately used on the labels was electrophonic after an early fling as new process. There's electrophonic. And here we have backwards, of course. in my own fashion. And we have flip side is. we have the new process. Oh. I was being so careful about that, but anyway, be that, we'll go back to it. Look at it backwards. Let me see now, where am I? These records, I feel it safe to say, were along with the autograph, the first electrical recordings offered to the public. It is not surprising that Victor felt that they must tell all about their process in the mid-25 or lose the publicity value to Compo, which was never reticent to reveal anything if it embarrassed the Victor Talking Machine Company. And Compo was a force to be reckoned with in the Canadian market. Hadn't their 65-cent line forced the majors to cut their prices after the halcyon days of the $1 10-inch popular record? Was Compo, too, who promised to pay the legal fees for any dealer who wished to sell the Compo line and was thereby sued by Victor for breaking their exclusivity clause in the contract? I feel certain that Compo's obvious success with both electrical recordings and as a producer of Canadian material provoked Victor of Canada into reactivating their recording studios, which had slipped into the doldrums with the departure of H.S. Brunner, and then became absolutely silent with the advent of the electrical process. The double impetus of H.S. The double impetus of Berliner and the Diamond Jubilee of Confederation in 1927, I think, were the reasons Victor set up equipment finally in Montreal. Here then is Victor's flashiest jubilee souvenir. As I say, like plastic Mounties made in Japan, which are sold in Toronto now. It was recorded in Camden, New Jersey. And compo's off-the-air recordings are far more interesting as historical documents. Now, to conclude, as my time is rapidly vanishing, I will play you, if I can run this equipment, a very early compo electrical recording, which is, again, Shall I Have It Bobbed or Shingled, played by the Diamond Trio. Now, this was recorded, I think it was recorded in June of 1925. Now, my notes will surface in a minute, but I'll see if I can run this. Saxophone's name, I think, is Alex Lajoie. So as you can hear, compo was producing, for all intents and purposes, a workable process. I have one other example. Which is the backwards recording that I showed you. This is Norton Payne, recorded by landline from the Capitol Theater in Montreal. And I think and since this is Irving Berlin's 100th anniversary of his birth, I mean, it's appropriate that this is the tune always. This is fighting me fang and claw. Audiovisual is designed to embarrass, you know, anybody who uses it. But anyway, be that as it may, I'm out of time. If you're interested afterwards, you can hear the Norton Payne side. And anyway, that's a quick introduction to the electrical process in Canada. So thank you very much. If anybody is more technologically sophisticated than I would be pleased to have them run that tape machine, which is. It doesn't like it. It keeps stopping. So.
I see what's happening. The set's been twisted.
Ah.
There's a segment there where it's.
How to lose your audience in 5 easy seconds.
Thank you.
There. I feel like I should be going for popcorn.